The clerk will call the docket.
James Ambrosio against Jane Wolfenow. Derek McClanahan, Zach Miller, Keith Allen, Kimberly Ann Murphy, Jennifer Lee Stevens for the athletes.
You may proceed.
Your Honor, may I ask?
Yeah. Do you have the clock ready to go?
Yes, sir.
All right, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Derek McClanahan from the law firm McClanahan Powers. I'm here today on behalf of the petitioner in the case and the underlying plaintiff, or really petitioner because it was a bill to impeach the will, Mr. James D'Ambrosio. This case is before the court on appeal from a dismissal with prejudice and a plea and bar on the basis of res judicata and judicial estoppel. The underlying claim in this case is with regards to a bill to impeach a will. It was challenged both on undue influence and testamentary capacity. The claim for res judicata, or the circuit court's ruling with regards to res judicata, was with regards to a prior proceeding that had occurred with regards to a petition for guardianship and conservatorship of the party who ultimately was the decedent in the bill to impeach the will. And as a preliminary, or sort of getting to the heart of one of the positions that the petitioner takes in his appeal and the plaintiff took in the case with regards to contesting the plea and bar for res judicata, is that the bill to impeach the will was not an applicable, the will in this case was not an operative document until the date of death of the decedent. And in this particular case, the petition that was underlying this, that made up the basis for res judicata, occurred while the decedent was still alive and essentially came to a conclusion while the decedent was still alive. As a result, the petitioner in this case takes the position that the court erred in ruling that there was. And Your Honors, I apologize. I'd like to interrupt myself and reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
All right. Can I ask you this? The debate over whether or not a declaratory judgment action could have been brought prior to probate, is that really the right question? I would think the right question would be, irrespective of whether a DEC action could be brought, was the claim accrued for res judicata purposes? Because if it was not an accrued claim prior to probate, then it can't be the bar doesn't apply as a matter of law.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And potentially, hopefully we conveyed, or we attempted to convey that argument as well, even if inartfully done. I think that's absolutely right, and the way we were approaching it with regards to the accrual of the action, I think we in our brief, we focused very heavily on the operative document, but I think the ultimate issue of whether or not the action has accrued is part and parcel to the argument that the res judicata claim was not appropriate at that time, and that we...
So reason through this with me, isn't it possible, in fact, isn't it probable that since the DEC action statute was meant to permit the assertion of claims prior to accrual, that there can be many opportunities to present a DEC action that would never trigger claim preclusion for res judicata purposes if, in fact, the accrual were after the DEC action? So therefore, the debate over whether or not the POA has standing to file the DEC action on a particular subject matter is really not enough of a question to answer the problem we have. Do you follow me?
I believe so, Your Honor. Sort of paraphrasing it, Beck, it's sort of putting the cart before the horse.
That's what I'm trying to say, yes.
And I think I would agree. I believe that is the case that we have here, ultimately, in addition to the other parts. So, ultimately the action that would have been at issue, or if there had been a controversy, didn't become live until a later point. So the action had never accrued in order for there to have been a declaratory judgment.
Well, it's live enough for a deck action. It can, in fact, a deck action is meant to be able to assert a claim prior to accrual. That was the whole purpose of the deck action statute. So it's live enough for a deck action to be filed, but it still is pre-accrual for race judicata purposes.
I agree with you, Your Honor.
Now, did you make that argument on appeal, the one I just made to you?
I would say, Your Honor, yes, I believe that we did.
It's a pretty subtle point, I grant you, but all right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So in one of our assignments of error, we specifically challenged whether or not the deck action should have been made. I think made up in that argument is whether or not despite whether it could have been made, whether or not it had accrued, I think is a finer point within the confines of the argument we had attempted to make. I don't know if I sufficiently answered your question.
No, you did. Thank you.
With regards to the deck action, generally, the question, and I'm going to go a little bit out of order, and I hope I'm not jumping around too much, but with regards to the deck action following along, I think one of the errors that the court made in identifying the deck action generally is that with a deck action, in this case, building off of the power of attorney, is fundamentally the party, the real party and interest in that situation is not Mr. James D'Ambrosio. So for purposes of res judicata, we're not in a situation where Mr. James D'Ambrosio is asserting a claim as the real party and interest on his own behalf. What we would essentially be saying, or what the court would ultimately be saying, is you should have brought a claim on behalf of this third party at that time. But now, for res judicata purposes, we actually have two different parties fundamentally. We essentially have Mr. James D'Ambrosio, who is now the real party in interest for as beneficiary and challenging his, the bill to impeach the will, versus with he had operated under the power of attorney, the real party in interest at that time is fundamentally the decedent. Because Mr. James D'Ambrosio is acting under the power of attorney on behalf of the decedent. Otherwise, he wouldn't have any ability or standing to do so. And real party and interest issues, and that's one of the assignments of error that we try to identify, is that fundamentally, in order for there to be res judicata, the parties have to essentially be the same. And that comes down to a real party and interest analysis. And that's why I think the deck action is confounding, and we deal with it on a number of different issues, because I think there's numerous problems, and I believe that the court erred in making that ruling, and really for a number of reasons, which I think may have caused us to not identify or not focus on that particular issue that you would identify with accrual as much as we probably would have liked.
May I interrupt you one more time? Does it matter in your thinking that the counterclaim was not reasserted in response to the third amended petition?
That the counterclaim is not reasserted in the third amended petition?
In other words, the affirmative pleading in the first case is being amended, right?
Yes,
and there are new responsive pleadings being filed each time, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, does it matter? I'm not asserting that it does. I'm asking you that the counterclaim doesn't appear in the responsive pleading to the third amended petition, which was the operative petition before the court in the first case. Or maybe I have my facts wrong. Was it asserted?
Was the counterclaim asserted in the petition? I don't know if it was actually part of the... I believe all of the pleadings were part of the underlying record in this case, but...
Well, what I'm saying is you got a first petition, second amendment petition, third amendment petition, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you got responsive pleadings to each one.
Mm-hmm.
I found the counterclaim to the first petition,
mm-hmm.
right? I didn't see the counterclaim reasserted in response to the third amended petition. I may have missed it, but did I miss it? And if I didn't miss it, does that matter?
I'm not sure that the position... This is an interesting question. So ultimately, would they have had to reassert the counterclaim with the subsequent petition?
That's what I'm asking. I don't know.
My instinct would be that the counterclaim would, in the event of like a demurrer, if there had been a counterclaim and demurrer filed contemporaneously with an answer, that the counterclaim could have potentially gone on despite the underlying principal claim. So had the principal claim been dismissed, that would not inherently dismiss the counterclaim. But in full candor, Your Honor, I haven't spent a lot of time focusing on
okay.
that particular
issue. Move on then.
Well, your position, as I understand it, is that the real party in interest in the first suit was Nancy, the deceased.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the real party in interest in the second suit is James.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it really doesn't make any difference to you what the answer to that question is it?
Not particularly, no, Your Honor. Not for purposes of, I think, identifying that there was an error in the circuit court ruling in favor of res judicata. I believe that the issue that you just identified...
Well, I searched the record. I didn't see the answer or the counterclaim on the third amended complaint. I don't think it's there. I couldn't find it. But I'm wondering whether it makes any difference to your argument whether it's there.
I don't believe it does. I think if it's not there, it only would further support that there's not evidence within the record to identify that there would be sort of an underlying basis that had made the challenge of the will that much more valid. But if anything, I think it supports our position, but fundamentally, the heart and soul of the argument we're making is not predicated on it. And again, with regards to...
But if the counterclaim doesn't exist, there's no compulsory counterclaim rule in Virginia, there's no hook for res judicata to begin with. Why are we even talking about it?
The position that the court ends up asserting is that it was asserted in the affirmative defense under unclean hands.
Well, that's an affirmative defense is not a claim, it's a defense. A claim preclusion applies to claims, not defenses. If that were not true, then the rule against compulsory counterclaims wouldn't exist under res judicata in Virginia. In other words, the responsive pleadings in a civil case do not trigger claim preclusion because responsive pleadings are not claims. They're defenses.
I would agree with your position. And I think that in the court ultimately makes that decision, and I think in error, as we identify in our petition, they identify that the unclean hands defense as an affirmative defense, therefore, is claim relief. They cite to, I'm forgetting what case the circuit court cites to try to support that proposition, but ultimately, I agree, I don't think asserting unclean hands brought the issue.
Well, to put a finer point on it, I think what Justice Kelsey is saying is that if that's his position, that's fine. But when did you make it yours?
When did we take the position that unclean hands didn't make it part of the same?
No, that there was a claim that was there, as opposed to a defense. The counterclaim that's missing from the third amended complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Kelsey's question is right on the point. The question to you is, when did you make it your issue? I didn't see that argument anywhere in the case.
Within the confines of our brief and challenge of what Judge Tran was saying, fundamentally, Your Honor, I think what we end up addressing, and perhaps I'm speaking out of turn if it wasn't that clear, but I think we specifically addressed the issue that unclean hands is not sufficient, and perhaps we didn't take the other sentence, which is because the counterclaim isn't asserted or isn't reasserted. Is that, if that's what you're...
Well, I guess, as I'm listening to the exchange, what your best position is that it doesn't matter to you, that you have other reasons why you should prevail. But go ahead.
So I would...
Excuse me. Take a break. Thank you. Thank you for catching him.
Have you called for help?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Well, you still have 7 minutes and 14 seconds left, so you may proceed.
So, again, to finalize that particular issue, Your Honor. I do agree with you that ultimately I don't think that is... I think we would prevail regardless of that, but I do believe that we challenge the court's decision in rendering ultimately whether or not unclean hands was sufficient. And within making that argument, if not expressly stated, we imply and the inferences, I think, drawn from the decision we're taking is if unclean hands is not sufficient and therefore there's no other argument made asserting that we have brought this issue to the forefront, then we're sort of saying by extension that if there's no counterclaim in the record, there was nothing to identify to say that this claim has ever been raised. So I believe that we directly assert that this claim has never been raised. And in so doing, we say unclean hands, and by virtue, there's nothing else to analogize against it. The other issue with regards to focusing on some of the other arguments, Your Honor, is that the power of attorney, or in this case, to allow for as the court identified, for someone to challenge an operative document in this case when there's other remedies available for an individual. So when we use the power of attorney to operate the way they're asking us to operate in this case, or the court would want us to, what's really happening is if we take the power of attorney out of the equation, we're just saying an individual really fundamentally can challenge their own will. I mean, that's really what it's boiling down to when the power of attorney is being used to challenge it. So I draft a will and I don't like it. I file a declaratory judgment, or I want to make sure that it's proper. I file a declaratory judgment as the individual who drafted the will to determine if it's going to be valid. And I think that's fundamentally improper. There are other remedies. They can tear up the will. They can draft a new one. And the court, to try to get around that issue, identifies that, oh, well, maybe they didn't have capacity. And so, again, highlighting the problem is much of the case law in Whedon v. Whedon and some of the other cases that have identified this is that we recognize that people can come in and out of lucidity, can come in and out of capacity. And, again, I think that supports the proposition that until the individual has passed away, it's just not operative for purposes of challenge, or for purposes, and then ultimately, in this case, for purposes of res judicata. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the remainder of time for...
All right.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Kimberly Murphy, and I, along with Ms. Jennifer Stevens, represent the appellees, Elector D'Ambrosio and Jane Wolfe, in this matter. As has been argued by the appellant, this case comes to appeal based on a plea and bar that was heard by the Fairfax County Circuit Court, and an order was entered dismissing the complaint to impeach the last will and testament of Nancy D'Ambrosio. As the Circuit Court points out in Judge Tran's opinion, this case, the prior action involving the guardianship of Nancy D'Ambrosio, was a very hard-fought and very long-fought case that involves several different issues. Addressing the counterclaim situation, there were three different petitions filed. There was the first, an amended, and a third amended petition. A counterclaim was not refiled in response to each of the successive amendments. That leave wasn't sought, but the counterclaim had always been asserted throughout the litigation. It was actually disposed of in the order granting the guardianship. It actually dismissed with prejudice Mr. D'Ambrosio's counts in the counterclaim. But the case
identify, if you will, the claims that we're talking about. Your case involves claim preclusion, issue preclusion, and judicial estoppel. Those are the three things that you have alleged. Match up the claims, if you will, that either were there or could have been there.
Okay. So in terms of the claims that were made, there were certainly allegations as to the validity of the 2013 financial durable power of attorney, which was executed in September of 13, that was brought by Mr. D'Ambrosio as count one of his counterclaim. In count two, there was an action, a declaratory judgment action, same as the first count, declaratory judgment on the healthcare power of attorney that was executed on May 31st of 2014. And there was also, as part and parcel to that counterclaim, a request for guardian and conservatorship in the event that Mrs. D'Ambrosio was deemed to be incapacitated at that time.
But nowhere therein was there a claim that the will was invalid, either because of undue influence or lack of testamentary capacity or anything, correct?
Within that counterclaim, no, Your Honor, it was not. The gravamen, I guess, and this is where all of the pleadings and the issues sort of start conflating is you have an answer, and I understand. In the answer, there was an affirmative defense of unclean hands where the daughters, you know, procured this document without the knowledge or consent of the son.
What document?
The will, the 2014 will. That was part of the answer to the third amended petition filed by the son. That was part of his affirmative defense to that petition.
So are you asserting claim preclusion applies to an affirmative defense?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so without the counterclaim, there can be no claim preclusion as a matter of first principles.
Well, I do believe, though, that this could have been brought. I think we're looking at...
But I mean, there has to be a hook. The hook, because there's no compulsory counterclaim rule, unlike the federal system. If there's a permissive counterclaim filed, then you have your hook. Well, you have a permissive counterclaim filed, but it has to be filed.
It was filed. It was asserted throughout the entire course of litigation. There was never a withdrawal of the counterclaim. There was never a dismissal of the counterclaim. There was never a non-suit of the counterclaim. It was always live. It was just never reasserted every time the petition was amended. And I don't know of any rule that says that if you don't reassert it in response to an amended main claim, that it's automatically dismissed.
But I think the point that's being made is that the counterclaim doesn't have anything to do with the will.
The counterclaim does not. And the whole principle that the court looked at was not that, yes, he actually brought the determination on the 2014 will. I know Judge Tran's opinion actually looks at the answer and grounds of defense and says, look, the appellant asserted that the 2014 will was procured by this doctrine of unclean hands, and that was sort of the hook. What we're saying is he, during the entire course of litigation, had the opportunity, vis-a-vis the guardianship action that he counterclaimed with, because part of the guardianship statute says you have a determination as to the nature and extent of the party's incapacity, the respondent's incapacity, particularly to determine whether or not that person is susceptible to abuse, neglect, those kinds of things. It's in that context that Mr. D'Ambrosio, he took the extra steps. He was acting as the agent under power of attorney. He was asserting a jury demand on behalf of his mother using the power of attorney. He was taking all of these steps, acting under this document, and then goes right up until the brink, asking for more discovery, doing all of these things.
Let's suppose everything you say is absolutely right, that there could have been a DEC action brought prior to probate, that the DEC action statute would have authorized standing in this particular party. Let's assume all of that arguendo is right. But it's still an unaccrued claim. And the general black letter law is that res judicata does not apply to claims that are unaccrued. Whereas the DEC action law allows the assertion of claims but doesn't compel the assertion of claims prior to accrual. So what am I missing about the logic of this? Doesn't that end the case for you in terms of res judicata?
From our perspective, it doesn't. From our perspective, and I understand the court's position on that black letter rule, but it also, the whole idea of res judicata is also to prevent exactly what's going on here, which is the successive lawsuits where it's never ending. So people, what it's doing is it allows people to walk into a court, make one little assertion and an answer and grounds of defense saying, this document is the product of unclean hands, allow them unfettered discovery, using the court system to essentially bulk up on their next case, and then as soon as the person dies, go, aha, I have standing, now I can come at you a second time. And what we're asking for is just a line. Where is a line going to be drawn that says you guys are not allowed to do this? These family disputes are only growing here in the Commonwealth.
I thought the line was after accrual. You cannot bring a partial half case prior after the accrual of all the claims, but you can prior to the accrual of all the claims.
But the capacity of an individual accrues during their lifetime. The determination of the capacity is actually what we're talking about. Just because a person's individual claim in that ambulatory document, their accrual doesn't arise until the person dies, doesn't mean that during the lifetime of their parent or a person under the guardianship statute, doesn't mean that the determination as to their capacity and whether or not what they've done is permissive or allowed because they were taken advantage of,
I completely agree with you. I don't know if I'm making the point well. The fact that they're standing under the DEC action to challenge a will prior to probate is a good thing for exactly the reasons you say. but no one's compelled to because it's not accrued yet. It's not been probated yet. There's no law saying you must bring this action now because it's accrued. Because, best I can tell, there is no accrual until probate of the will that's being challenged.
I agree that there is no accrual in Mr. D'Ambrosio individually as a beneficiary. However, Mrs. D'Ambrosio was alive during the time. Her capacity was very much at issue. It was very much a source of dispute and extreme hostility between these siblings. That capacity, that determination was always live, and that did provide the ability for the parties to litigate that, and really should have. If you're going to go through all of that discovery and do all of those things, why not bring the action? If the court determined he didn't have standing and they dismissed it on that basis, we wouldn't have an argument about it at all, because the court wouldn't have allowed it to go forward, and the possibility wouldn't have even been there, because the court would have determined it and kicked it. Our problem...
Isn't that one of the issues before us? That's precisely one of the issues, whether the court should not have done that.
I understand. Most of my practice is with either trust and estates after someone dies or with guardianships. And the biggest problem you see is when you've got gray cases. And this is one of those cases where everything was done, bringing everybody up to the brink of making a determination. And I guess where we're coming from is where is the bar to a successive lawsuit? Because in my client's view, you know, being litigation tired, they just want an end, and they thought there was an end in the last lawsuit, only to find out that there's another one, and that because of this technicality that a beneficiary can only bring something after death, boom, it didn't accrue, so I can sue you a second time. It just, there is something that's...
It's really not quite a technicality. You asked for a line.
Yes.
The line is quite clear, and it applies to all of us. It's death. Or death, theoretically, somebody who lacks capacity could regain capacity. Theoretically, any number of things can happen. After death, that will can't be changed.
But does that line necessarily say that a guardian of the incapacitated person can't bring an action to challenge a document? Does that line say that an agent under power of attorney can't do it? I mean, the line that's being...
No, it doesn't say that. It can be standing in a deck action in some cases to file a in fact, that's the whole point of the deck action statute, is to permit premature, unaccrued claims to be asserted under certain circumstances. So it can. The question is not can it be asserted, did it have to be asserted? And as Justice Mintz just pointed out, the line for have to asserting something is accrual across the board generally. Why isn't that rule applicable here?
Because of all of the steps that were taken in the prior action, acting as though this was such an important and viable issue.
Well, you know, you would win collateral estoppel irrespective of accrual if the specific factual issue were in play, but it wasn't. So, I mean, it's not like the law gives no remedy in these situations. If there's actually a fact-finding determination in the prior suit, when we're not dealing with claim preclusion but issue preclusion, you would win if the facts had been determined that way. But that obviously didn't happen in this case for the reason just mentioned. There was no determination at the time of the person's death that incapacity existed or not.
No, the actual determination as to whether Nancy D'Ambrosio's incapacity, what the extent was, whether it was below the testamentary capacity or not, no, that determination was not made. The other situation, the other issue was obviously the judicial estoppel and the taking of one set of positions in one case and then turning around and taking another. The complaint for impeachment, Mr. D'Ambrosio takes the position, well, mom's stroke in 2012 rendered her completely incapable of knowing what was going on, understanding what her property and possessions were, and yet in the prior lawsuit, and in particular in his counterclaim, he asserts in Exhibit B, he attaches a letter, and in that letter he asserts, I've only had to use the power of attorney on four different occasions, that mom is directing me to do certain things, and if this is an individual who is not capable of understanding the objects of their bounty and not capable of understanding what property and finances they have, then how are they able to direct an agent acting on their behalf under a power of attorney? And I think that gets really kind of gets into the core of the judicial estoppel piece is, again, how far do you allow somebody to bring these actions if they're asserting one claim in one context and then turn around after death and assert another one? Testamentary capacity is much lower than the standard for incapacity, generally speaking, in the guardian and conservatorship statutes. In the guardian and conservatorship statutes, the incapacity looks at specifically a person's ability to take in information and process it to be able to make decisions as to their health or their finances. In the testamentary capacity domain, it's actually to look solely, it's to look at, does the person know the objects of his or her bounty? Can they tell you who they want to leave their things to? You know, do they know what they have? And can they say, this is who I want to leave my things to?
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
As long as we're trying to narrow what it is that's before us, you have claim preclusion, issue preclusion, and judicial estoppel.
Yes.
Let's move to issue preclusion for just a moment, because most of our discussion here has been claim preclusion. In fact, I think all of it has been claim preclusion. Issue preclusion requires that the issue actually be litigated and decided. Now, as I look at this case, the capacity that Nancy had to execute her will was not decided in the first litigation.
The capacity to make a will was not. There's language in the order, as I pointed out in our brief, that said that as of the time of the order, she's no longer to do anything with her property. But there was no factual determination. Correct, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't that end the question of whether or not issue preclusion applies when the subject matter of the second lawsuit is her capacity to make a will?
Yes and no. The whole issue about what Nancy was doing throughout the guardianship order does not dispose of that issue. Yes, Your Honor. And it was not requested in the counterclaim. That was not done.
Well, then that leaves judicial estoppel, and
yes.
that would be that James somehow is making inconsistent positions before the courts. In the second action, James is claiming that Nancy lacked testamentary capacity to make the will in February of 2014. How is that inconsistent with claims that have to do with the May 2014 medical power of attorneys? Aren't they two different things?
They are two different things.
Well, if they're two different things, then it's not inconsistent, is it?
It is when the person is making claims in the counterclaim that says, I've been assisting mom with her finances, but she is basically in charge. I am helping her write the checks, but she's the one making the decisions. It all goes against, well, if this person doesn't know what their finances are, what the objects of their bounty are, then how is it that they're able to direct an agent? He speaks in broad brush of like, yeah, she had some diminished capacity after the 2012 stroke, but it didn't do anything. It really didn't impair her. I'm able to continue handling things with her. We're working together. I'm not really using my power of attorney. That's the essence of his argument, which belies that she lacked testamentary capacity. If this person is, he doesn't say, well, at all times, with the exception of February 7th, 2014, or she had a bad moment or a bad stroke or something that occurred within this window, and says this is the reason why she has this period of diminishment, but then she was okay in May 31 of 2014, and she was okay in September of 2013. There's none of that that was going on at all in the prior action. And when you're alleging a capacity that's up here, and then come back in the successive lawsuit and say, well, she didn't even have down here. I don't know how you even reconcile those two. And it's exactly what Judge Tran said. The positions, he's just flipped where he was because now it's...
Well, isn't the answer that it's two different times?
I would say no, because he wasn't speaking in two different times in the prior action. He was making it sound like this was her capacity was this continuum that was maintained throughout this entire course. It wasn't that he it wasn't that he says, as of September, yes, as of May, no, and then just kind of left it blank in between. He actually spoke in terms of continuums. He attached exhibits to his counterclaim that spoke in terms of this continuum of capacity. And if you're going to talk in terms of a continuum of capacity, then come back and say, well, but, and then come back in the second suit and say, yep, right after the 2012 stroke, boom, she just started going downhill and didn't know what she was doing, didn't have any idea. So then why did you argue the opposite in the prior action, and why should he be allowed to profit from that, to be able to file a second action? I mean, that's, if that were the case, if you were actually lying in wait, why wouldn't you just say, well, in February, she was bedridden, she was in a hospital, she was unconscious, she had some sort of stroke, she had something that says that in that period of time, maybe she had capacity, maybe she didn't, but she resumed here in May and she had it over here in September. There was nothing there. It was, she's been fine. She's doing all of these things. She's participating with me. I think that's where the judicial estoppel comes into play, and where we have all of this discovery that's being commenced on exactly what's going on, when, where, and how. That's where, again, that's where, you know, my clients are at, is there's got to be some sort of, you can't just do that. You can't flip it. You can't be in a guardianship action and say, yeah, mom's fine. Mom's great. Yeah. And I've been managing for her. She knows how to do everything. She's managing with me. And then right after death say, oh, I think I'm gonna say she lacks even the lowest form of capacity. If he hadn't made any assertions in the prior action, if he hadn't filed any pleadings, if he hadn't done anything, really, then I don't think we would ever have that opportunity to argue it. So we respectfully request that this court affirm the trial court's decision in this matter.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Your Honors, I'll take up from where counsel was leaving off with regards to the judicial estoppel issue. Fundamentally, I disagree with the characterization of the counterclaim as being a continuity of position and making any assertion whatsoever that during February 2014 she had capacity to draft that will. I mean, that would be sort of tacitly incorrect. So I think just sort of as based on the facts that are in the record, I don't agree with that representation. Assuming that, again, the counterclaim is in play and this is even a discussion point, but assuming arguendo it is, and assuming arguendo that there were facts that indicated that prior to February 2014 there was capacity and afterwards there was, again, the issue, and I think it's well established in Virginia law, is that we look at the individual when she drafted the will, the capacity she had at that moment, and that was certainly never part of the petition, and for conservatorship and guardianship. Really, the petition for conservator and guardianship establishes, does she have capacity now? Does she need a guardian and conservator now? Which would have been subsequently after the February 2014 drafting of the document. Also, and I think important to note, to the extent that the counterclaim is in play, the counterclaim asserted an alternate position that in the event the power of attorney, etc., is not valid, that Mr. D'Ambrosio would request that he act as conservator or guardian, which would, to me, indicate that he wouldn't be taking an inconsistent position because he would be asserting alternatively that, in fact, to the extent there is incapacity, I would want to be petitioner. So I don't think the judicial estoppel bar, I think that the court erred in granting that under judicial estoppel for the items I identified. I don't think that's compelling to... Was that?
No, you go right ahead.
Okay.
There's no trap door.
I thought maybe I had done something.
You might want to step to the side of the podium.
We're trying to find a way to interrupt your argument as often as possible.
With regards to issue preclusion, Your Honor, I think the assessment was correct. The issue is kind of jumping back down again. Sorry to move around on you. I think, Your Honor's assessment on that is correct. Ultimately, that issue is never decided. It's never before the court in any way, and this issue is never dispositively resolved in any way. So I don't think the case claim could be barred by issue preclusion. At this time, Your Honors, if there's no other questions for me, I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.